Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look at Donald Trump and the United States with David Frum. David recently published his second book on the Trump presidency, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. It complements Trumpocracy, the Corruption of the American Republic. I recommend both books for those who want to get a sense of the Trump presidency and how it has changed our southern neighbor. They are lively reads, and to give you an example of its spirited prose, Frum writes that Trump rules, quote, in the style of authoritarian third world kleptocrat. David is a senior editor at The Atlantic and the author of 9 books. I especially recommend his novel, Patriots. Born in Toronto, David is a citizen of both Canada and the United States. He served as a speechwriter to George W. Bush. David and I met when I was posted in New York and he was doing his undergraduate work at Yale. Later, when I was posted to Washington, David and his wife, Danielle, were a great help to me in the embassy for both their insights and their generous introductions to those I needed to know. For listeners, Trumpocracy is a book in 2 parts. The first half looks at the damage wrought by Trump with titles such as The Deep State Lie, Real versus Unreal, Americans, Real versus Unreal Americans, White Terror, and then lifts to A New Age of Reform, where David makes recommendations about how to make the system work better, unite the United States, create a greener planet, and move against the current temperament that's in the United States. David, welcome to the Global Exchange.
Thank you, Colin. It's so good to talk to you.
David, you write that, quote, democracy is tested by its ability to deliver security, prosperity, and justice. By that standard, how's the great republic doing under Mr. Trump?
By that standard, I think all of our democracies are doing less well in the 21st century than they did in the 20th. I think many of the people who listen to a podcast like this will greatly value democracy as a system of liberty and freedom and human dignity. But we have had sad experience in the developed world and the undeveloped world that democracies that don't deliver material goods are much less stable than democracies that do. And we need to get back in the business of delivering steady, reliable, and rising material benefit to our citizens if we want to see off the authoritarian alternatives that have become more attractive in the 21st century than they did in the last third of the 20th.
So I guess what you're saying then is that this is not particular to the United States, but this is something that is a challenge for all democracies. And I guess when you look across, you think of what's taking place in Britain with Brexit and Macron with the Gilets Jaunes, in Germany with the alternative parties, and you know, think of places like Hungary, the democracies are having a tougher time. And I don't think Canada is necessarily immune to this.
The years since 2005 have been described as a democratic recession. The number of democracies in the world increased very dramatically between 1985 and 2005, not just with the end of communist rule over Central and Eastern Europe, but on the Pacific Rim and in such places as Chile, even Mexico. So long, a one-party fake democracy became an authentic competitive democracy in the 21st century. But since 2005, both the number of democracies has been shrinking and the quality of democracy, even within those countries that remain formal democracies, is deteriorating. And I think Hungary, at this point, we can describe as an authoritarian regime. Poland is headed that way. Mexico is headed that way. And Brazil, even more distressing. Canada has been, on this round, one of the less dirty shirts in the bag of laundry. Canada, along with Australia and Germany, has resisted many of the new authoritarian temptations. But there's no special immunity. And remember that at other times in history, like the 1930s, Canada and Canadians became very susceptible to authoritarian populist governments at the provincial level.
Yes, and I guess, as you say, you know, is this another sort of cycle of history? I remember reading Arthur Schlesinger's book about cycles of American history, and arguably we're in another one of those. But is this something that you think afflicts democracies, although in relative terms, democracies, of which the United States arguably is the oldest, are a relatively new phenomenon in world history?
The United States as a full democracy is not so old as all that. The 15th Amendment, which said that voting cannot be abridged on grounds of race, was passed in 1870 and only became effective in the middle 1960s. So even if we can accept that a country that doesn't give votes to women can be described as a democracy, because in that case, they're a purely 20th century phenomenon, even among men, the United States has not had a non-racial democracy That's a new phenomenon in our lifetimes. And democracy has ebbed and flowed in the United States. There are periods where popular power, the ability of people to have a say over their own future, has increased. And there are periods in which it has constricted. And since 2010 in the United States especially, as Republicans have become more pessimistic about their ability to prevail in democratic competition, their strategy for survival has been increasingly to limit the vote of people who are not going to support them, to unbalance the political system so that rural and white votes count for a lot more than urban and non-white votes. And then finally to entrust their fate to Donald Trump, who has done so much to overthrow democratic norms, including such basics as the president should answer questions when Congress asks them.
At one point you talk about, I think you cite Ted Cruz, who compares Trump to Benito Mussolini. You know, you did that, I guess, by design. There are similarities in their posture and some of their bluster. Is that fair?
Well, I want to be careful about comparing democratic problems of today to those of the 1930s. As I often joke, there are a lot of stops on the train line of bad before you get to Hitler station. I think one of the excellent reasons to study history is so you get a larger stock of comparison than just the Third Reich all the time. There are other episodes of democratic decline in American history. The United States had its own indigenous examples of democratic decline. I talk about this in the first of the two books, Trumpocracy, that in 1870, a state like South Carolina would have hundreds of thousands of people voting. By the 1920s, it had tens of thousands of people voting because they excluded not only almost all blacks from the franchise, but the majority of the state's whites as well. And we have seen other periods like that. The Ted Cruz quote was, "History is not kind to the man who holds Mussolini's overcoat." And I met that quote less as a reflection on Donald Trump as Mussolini than as a reflection on what has happened to Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz knows what Donald Trump is, as do Lindsey Graham, as do Marco Rubio, as do so many of the other senators. And yet they have enabled him rather than doing what the constitutional system expects the Senate to do, acting as an independent check on him, even regardless of the same party.
And so that, to get you back to your one of the main points of both books, is what's happened to the grand old party.
I would say what's happened to Congress.
Yes, well, that's and when the Republicans were in charge of Congress, yes, certainly that's the case. I guess is the trade-off, as Mitch McConnell and others might say, well, look, we'll get our conservative judges, we get tax reform, so we'll just stick with what there's a lot about Trump we don't like, but there are things that he can deliver that will work for what we want to achieve, and therefore you make that sort of devil's bargain?
I think that's more rationalization than an explanation. McConnell could have gotten the same crop of judges through, even if he had checked Donald Trump on matters of ethics. He didn't need to give Trump a pass on operating a private business while president, on directing millions of dollars of public money into Trump's pocket. Many more, by the way. Trump has taken even more than he's taken from the public. He's taken that much more from Republican Party donors. Republican Party events are now almost always held at Trump properties. So he's not only taken millions from the public, but he's taken probably tens of millions from the party, taken tens of millions from the inaugural committee. Donald Trump in 2017 raised more money for his inaugural fund than had ever been raised in history, more than $100 million. Inaugural funds are one of the least transparent pools of money available to a politician. Technically, they're private corporations, so they're immune to public disclosure. And it's voluntary to tell people who gave, and it's voluntary to tell people where the money was spent. And so we have a little bit of information on who gave to the Trump Inaugural Committee, but almost no information on how the money was spent. What we can see is that what was spent does not remotely, he didn't spend $100 million on his inaugural. Because remember, things like the security, that's paid for by the public. So where are the inaugural funds? I mean, a lot of people think they must have ended up in Trump's own pocket somewhere. And that's, again, a lot of money from Republican donors. McConnell didn't have to okay all of that to get his judges. There's something deeper going on.
So what is it? What is it that these are, as you pointed out just a couple of minutes ago, you've got people like Cruz and Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, all of whom were certainly, don't think of any great personal like for Donald Trump. If you look at the last campaign, running for the nomination, and Trump's belittling of them all, and Lindsey Graham in particular had some prime words to describe Trump, which I thought was fairly accurate. But why are they now, as you describe it, enabling them?
This is a million-dollar question. And I think the source of this was their discovery that Donald Trump had a stronger grip on the voting base of the Republican Party, of course, than they did. And I tell much of the story in the first of the two books, Trumpocracy, that after the Great Recession, after the Bush presidency, the leadership, the donors of the Republican Party, the elected officials went in one direction toward greater economic radicalism. And the voters, who had been very hard hit by the Great Recession, went in another. And the joke I use in Trumpocracy is that the voting Republicans said, we want more health care, less immigration, and no more Bushes. And the elite said, right, you're getting more immigration, less health care, and one more Bush. And that gap between leaders and led opened an opportunity for Donald Trump. And he then has exposed just how meaningless to Republican voters the ideas of Ted Cruz are. And Ted Cruz will talk about the sacred principles of conservative ideology, only to discover that Ted Cruz's own voters don't care about those principles at all. What they care about is the group-to-group competition that Donald Trump offers, whites against blacks, old against young, urban against rural. That's what excites them. And they like the cultural revenge that Donald Trump is taking on their self-identified cultural enemies. They don't care about taxes. They don't care about the size of government. Never have. They don't care about states' rights. What you see, it's such a striking thing in this pandemic, is a demand that national governments overrule the state, that states overrule local governments, and local governments overrule private businesses so that Trump voters don't have to wear masks. They decided that wearing a mask is a cultural issue. Now, from the point of view of conservative principle, a short store owner should be able to require a mask, and a city government should be able to impose it, and a state government should be able to be independent of the federal government. But at every turn, Trump voters have made clear, we think it's more important that we not have to go through what we regard as the humiliation of wearing masks than that our so-called principles be honored and the so-called rights of property and the so-called rights of local governments be upheld. We don't care about that at all.
So the U.S., as we go forward, will Trump have, is Trump truly changing the United States, or did he just simply appeal to that group of disaffected, what Hillary called them, the deplorables, that and through arguably some luck, and he becomes president? But can he continue to do this? Because certainly you're also seeing the checks and balances. The Supreme Court's not always ruling his way. The courts themselves have pushed him back on migration and things. He's not getting his way entirely with Congress. Certainly in 2018, in the midterms, you know, the Republicans lost the House, and arguably that was a demonstration of where Americans were, at least at the congressional level, because you get everybody in the sense of vote, and the Democrats come back in a big way. Is Trump simply a mistake? And it's sort of Mark Shields and others say the Americans will make a mistake once, but they won't make it twice.
Well, I do have a vision of the next American president going around the world, vowing to other countries that the United States will never, ever, ever mix tequila and Quaaludes ever again. I think Trump did luck into the presidency, or bad luck into the presidency. He wasn't, remember, his share of the popular vote was less than that of Al Gore or Mitt Romney or John Kerry. And I think there's a good chance that because of the pandemic, he will lose in 2020. But even if Trump doesn't represent something that doesn't have an enduring grip on power, the damage he has done at home will be difficult to correct. And the damage he's done to America's standing in the world will be extremely difficult to correct and may never be corrected at all. And let me talk about that second first. I worked in the Bush administration now close to 20 years ago. At that time, depending on exactly how you compute it, the American economy was somewhere between 3 and 5 times bigger than the Chinese economy. Today, depending on how you count it, the Chinese economy is something like 80% the size of the United States economy. And most of us listening to this program will see China probably catching up to the United States. If the last time the United States had an equal peer as an economic power was in the middle part of the 19th century, when the peer was the British Empire. Since in 1890, the United States becomes the biggest economy in the world. Sometime during the First World War, the United States overtakes the entirety of the British Empire all combined as the largest political unit on Earth. And through the 20th century, the United States was just effortlessly the richest and most powerful country on the planet. That time is coming to an end, and it's going to be a very different world. It's a difficult world, different and difficult world for us to adjust to. The only way you can maintain Western power and democratic power is by strong coalitions and partnerships. And of course, blowing those up has been Donald Trump's most settled conviction as president, and the thing he's done again and again. I think after Trump is gone, should he be gone, friendly countries will, of course, want to work together, overlook the past, but everyone will know that this is something that happened. This is something that is now in the realm of the possible. And if you're planning for the security of a non-U.S. country for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you have to take into account just possibly Donald Trump is not a fluke, but a harbinger of things to come. And you just need to keep that little bit more distant than you would have before he was elected.
No, I think that's right. I think that we all, for 70 plus years, the U.S. was the reliable partner. It was the guardian. Yes, there were differences and on policies. And as we know, we saw during Reagan's period, for example, there were frictions with the Europeans. But ultimately, the American dollar, the alliances were seen to be good credit that we could depend upon, even if all the members of the alliance were not necessarily paying their share. And I think that's where Donald Trump has had some effect, if you could say in a positive sense, in arguably frightening the members of the alliance. And so they are putting more in. But I do think that the reasons we created the alliance and then the economic frameworks still maintain. But it does require, and certainly you see this in the last few years, without the U.S. presence, it's very difficult to do the great things that the democracies were able to do. And so I think that, what's your advice to countries like Canada? I mean, you know both our countries extremely well. You know, Mr. Trudeau has, I think, done as good a job as possible to not make Mr. Trump unhappy with us. Whether that's the right approach or not, I think it probably is. But going forward, what does a country like Canada do? If we can't rely on the United States, then I guess that means we have to make more investments in, for example, our own security and look to different kind of trading relationship. But then what does that say for the rest of the alliance as well, as you mentioned, the Germanys and others that are like-minded in a way?
Well, Canada is in a very different boat from a Germany or a Japan. That Canada's, from a strategic point of view, is a fascinating country to study, as it's a country with almost no strategic options. It has relatively few strategic challenges, but no strategic options. There is only one policy available to Canada. Obviously, Canada cannot redirect its trade. That's geography has spoken. What Canada can do things at the margins, and you indicated one of them, is absolutely Canada needs to invest more in, I would say, non-defense security capabilities, intelligence above all, so that it knows more about the world around it without having to rely on its American partners for information. It should have more of its own eyes and ears. For strictly defense capabilities, Canada's strategic position has always been the same, which is Canada faces two kinds of defense challenges. One comes from the United States, and there's nothing that can be done about that. And the other comes from anywhere else on the world. And, of course, the Americans have to be involved in that. If some hostile power to try to take a chunk of the Canadian Arctic, that would be just as much a security concern of the United States as of Canada. But investments in CSIS, investments in, especially in a spectrum of threats that the Americans have proven themselves less interested in. You know, why Canada can't maintain, you know, the two dozen specialists inside China that the United States maintained before Donald Trump pulled them out. But it could have one person in the Chinese Department of Agriculture. Canada could have a richer suite of climate study capabilities. So those are things that Canada can do. The options for Germany and Japan and countries that are on sort of this more of the edge of the democratic world, those get larger. And I don't doubt that countries like, especially South Korea, are going to be working on being much more accommodating of China in the future post-Trump than they are right now.
So what kind of world do we wind up with then if the alliance structure is feebled and we're in a sense, I think you're right that we could certainly do more and should do more, as you say, on the intelligence side. And I think that means where we traditionally were good was on the diplomatic side. We also had sufficient hard power back in an earlier age, I think of Pearson and Saint Laurent, where we could send out, why we were able to do peacekeeping is because we actually had the capacity. Now we don't have quite that capacity. Things are expensive. But what you can do, as you say, is invest in intelligence. And because we are the world, that probably makes sense given migration and things. We go into that with an added advantage. And certainly my experience was that the intelligence that we could bring to Washington was always appreciated by whatever administration was, because we understand the United States better than any other country. And so when you bring stuff in, they're genuinely interested. Is that something we should continue to try to push?
Yeah, except you asked two questions there. Let me deal with the first one. What is the world going to look like? So from 1990 to, let us say, 2010, we lived in a world of one superpower, many partners, and a few troublemakers. From 1950 to 1990, we lived in a world of two great power blocks of rival powers. And with China, in the later part of it, China moving a little bit back and forth between them. China wasn't, in those days, the great power that it would later be. I think we're heading back now to the world of 1890, where we're going to have three or four mighty, mighty powers, the United States, China, India, and the European Union, even in its own way. And some of the powers will be friendlier with each other than others. The European Union and the United States will be friendlier, as Great Britain and France were friendlier in 1890 than either was with Germany. But they're not really going to be partners in the way they used to be, because one of the effects of the pandemic, and look, we have some choices here, some of these things we can prevent, but I think clearly we're moving toward there's going to be much more protectionism of medical technology. The idea that you should just buy your rubber gloves from the cheapest source, that's going to go out of style. I deplore that. I think we should still be buying our rubber gloves from the cheapest source, but the European Union and the United States are going to insist on making their own, and Canada will then be, I think, conscripted into joining a kind of NAFTA medical security bloc alongside Mexico, because the alternative is to do it on either to depend on someone who's not dependable or to try to do it on your own, which for a country of Canada's size is unfeasible. So I think we're going to move to a less cooperative world. I mean, I invest my own energy every day in trying to stop that trend, but the trend seems wrong.
So in a sense, less globalization and more regional pacts, which is sort of what we're seeing anyways, at least from a Canadian perspective. We go into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which arguably the U.S. was the driving force under Obama, but Trump pulls out. Perhaps the Americans come back. I think it would make sense. We've got a pact with Europe, and eventually I think the United States may come into something like that. And of course, we have the new SMACA, or Canada-U.S.-Mexico Agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I like that they gave it a name that made it sound like something painful.
SMACA, yes. Well, I want to turn back to the book, because in the last half of the book, you put forward a series of suggestions of how you can mitigate or repair some of the damage that Trump has done, money in politics, the filibuster in the Senate. Do you want to sort of take listeners through some of the things you think that could be done to help mitigate, as they say, some of the damage of Trump? Some of them, I think, quite Canadian: gun control, carbon tax, skills-based immigration, independent electoral boundary commissions, comprehensive health care. You know, I could almost see your Canadian roots coming through.
Yes, I do. Well, I certainly have. I'm sure I show that impress. But the thing I am concerned about in the United States is that Donald Trump has found the clash of group upon group as his primary political resource: mutual resentment, mutual mistrust. So my remedy to the risk of more bouts of Trumpism is to thicken the bonds of nationhood. And that means giving people practical attachment to the country. Abraham Lincoln famously invoked the mystic cords of memory, but I think there's a lot to be said for the substantial cords of money as well. So when people get a material benefit from their state, they feel more invested in their state than when they get fewer material benefits. So I'm looking for ways so that the average citizen has a deeper connection with the government of the United States, including, for example, something that looks more visibly like a universal healthcare system. Not because that's necessarily the best way to do healthcare, but it certainly is the best way to run a country. People feel they have a stake in this. At the same time, if you're going to have a thicker social safety net, the United States has to have a more effective border. You cannot countries that run a generous social safety net cannot just open that to anyone who chooses to show up and help themselves. You have to be selective in who you admit. The United States has a very casual attitude, very poor enforcement of immigration. So I argue for strict enforcement and lower numbers joined to a thicker social safety net as a way to make Americans feel more that they have something in common, and so they're less vulnerable to having specific identities swayed by Donald Trump.
And through that, the citizens' attachment to the state and the feeling that the state is also representing them goes some distance to, I guess, remove some of that angst and anger and resentment, in the sense that the government does not represent them, which has always been certainly part of the Trump base. Is that fair?
That's right.
If you succeed in that, you potentially start to change the culture. I mean, there's a great quote you use from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who I think says it's culture, not politics, that determines the success. And so what you're suggesting through some of that, your remedies, are things that begin to change the culture. And then ultimately, although you still need the politics, I think was the other flip side of the Moynihan quote, that you still need politicians to be able to do these things.
Well, Moynihan had this wonderful quote that the central conservative truth is that culture is more important than politics. And the central liberal truth is that politics can change culture and save a culture from itself.
And do you think that applies?
I think it does. You know, I have become, not again, I've warned against this This is not an analogy or comparison of any kind. It's just sort of suggestive. In the period of the Trump presidency, I've become a huge consumer of literature about the history of West Germany in the period after World War II. And we all read about World War II all the time, the famous battles and the battle for production. But what I've become increasingly interested in is how did the countries that underwent this horrifying, terrible, destructive experience, how did they build the model democracies that we see on the European continent today? And there were long periods when people wondered whether it could even happen at all. And yet it did, that we built true democratic cultures, and not only in Germany, but in France and Italy, places that had been resistant to them before. We've seen the growth of a democratic culture in Spain and Portugal, countries that were dictatorships until 1975, and that may have seen poor candidates for democracy when they overthrew their dictatorships, so the dictatorships ended in the middle of the 1970s. How is democratic culture and consciousness born? And there are lessons there. This has been done before. It's been done under more difficult circumstances. Surely we can do it again.
Although now we're applying it, in a sense, at home. And in a sense, what your sort of central thesis is that we need a renaissance of democracy in the democracies. Because for many years, and certainly for Eastern Europe, and I think in arguable parts of Russia, we were the attractive state, and certainly Chinese people that come to America, the attraction. But so what we need is a major undertaking. It's kind of to go back to the roots. And I think you're right, looking at how it happened, what Eisenhower did, and what took place in Japan, because these were extraordinary achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans led.
And I think what we're going to see, I say this again and again through the book, that democracy is always in motion. It's getting better or it's getting worse. Your institutions are getting stronger or they're getting weaker. Nothing stays the same. If you leave it alone, it doesn't stay the same. If you leave it alone, it changes. So the work of reform never ends. And that is done, that is as much a conservative as a liberal project. I quote Theodore Roosevelt more than a century ago saying that the reason he became a reformer is not because he was a socialist, but because he was an anti-socialist. And in the same way, if we want to if we want to protect the things we've already developed and maintain the stability of our society, we have to make adjustments to new realities. It's one of the great achievements of modern civilization is that we live longer and longer lives. And I was very struck. Our mutual friend Andrew Cohen wrote a book about the makers of Canadian foreign policy. He had, I'm now going to forget who he had, three or four people who he thought were, every one of them was dead by age 65, the cigarettes being the culprit in all the cases.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
We have people running for president at age 77 or 78, whatever. So we have a world in which people live longer, and that's a tremendous blessing, but it has a consequence, which is more and more of our voters and leaders are mentally living in a world that no longer exists. So we, as policymakers, as citizens, we have to constantly be refreshing our mind to the world as it is now, to a world in which the United States faces an economic peer in China, to a world in which of enormous cultural diversity and within our own countries, and a world in which, despite what everybody says, that diversity is not a strength, it is a challenge. And it has to be managed and to be successful, and in which wealth and power are concentrating, and that concentration has to be counteracted, and in which global migration flows are accelerating. 44 million people moved from the global south to the global north between 1990 and 2015, a quarter century. Biggest peaceful migration of human beings in history. And it is destabilizing politics not only on the receiving end, but on the sending end, too. Because when you have scale immigration on that scale, not only do you empower reactionary parties in the receiving countries, but the remittances home change class relations in the sending countries, that those families that have sent relatives into the North become richer than they were before relative to the families that didn't. And that's destabilizing, which is not to say you can turn an off switch and make it stop, but you have to recognize all these things as challenges to be managed and not just facts of life to be shrugged away.
David, one thing that comes through in all your books is your grasp of history and the importance of understanding where we came from, if only to understand where we are. Is that fair?
I think it is very fair. I think one of the most beautiful but also false statements was a line of Tom Paine's that Ronald Reagan loved to quote, "We have it in our power to make the world new again." No, we don't.
All right. Well, on that, let me ask you, what are you reading these days?
I am reading two things. I'm reading three things. Adam Zamorski's fantastic new biography of Napoleon. I'm reading the inside account of the impeachment of Ronald Reagan by Eric Swalwell, who served on the House Intelligence Committee. And I'm listening to Hilary Mantel's third volume of her Wolf Hall trilogy. I'm just loving that. But the experience I'm going to recommend most, I'm watching one of the greatest dramatic experiences I've ever had, the 70-plus part French miniseries, French Village, the story of the lives of people in a small town in southeastern France in the years under German occupation. It is just the most morally nuanced drama I think I have ever watched. It's difficult to see in Canada, but you can get the DVD box set, and anyone who is interested in the moral compromises that people have to make under adverse circumstances, I cannot recommend it strongly enough.
All right. Thank you. We were joined today by David Fromm in a discussion of his new book, Trumpocalypse, which follows on his earlier book, Mr. Trump, Trumpocracy. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.